D. E. Hoist, A Prince with God, Chapter 4, Hung Tung. The one thing the work needs is a head or captain, not too strong on the one hand, nor a weakling on the other, who would unite in one all the branches of work. Everything seems loose and consequently feeble. It was during the summer of 1886 when Hudson Taylor visited South Shaanxi, and that was his summing up of the situation regarding CIM work in the district. Much had been accomplished in the 10 years since the province was first entered. The great famine of 1877-78 had provided an opportunity for widespread relief work on the part of missionaries in their wholehearted and self-sacrificing efforts to alleviate the suffering around them. Did much to quiet the suspicions with which they had previously been regarded. In the following years, not a few souls were saved, among them men of strong character and with a real zeal for God's kingdom, HSI being the most outstanding of them all. Small groups of believers were being gathered out, willing and eager to be taught more of the power of their newfound Savior and how best they could follow Him. With the lack of organized supervision, however, there was a danger of each group becoming an isolated unit rather than a member of the living, growing body. Hudson Taylor saw the need for someone to be invested with authority in the eyes of the local Christians, and it seemed evident that the man already appointed of God for this position was HSI. Throughout the whole district, he was known and loved by the Christians, many of whom were his own spiritual children. It was largely through his opium refuge work that little churches were being established. What more fitting than that he should be openly acknowledged by missionary and Chinese alike as one called and appointed by God for a widespread pastoral ministry. At first, HSI, realizing additional responsibility that the position of ordained pastor would involve and deeply conscious of his own inadequacy, was unwilling to accept it. He was evidently persuaded that it was the Lord's will, however, and once convinced on that point, he refused no longer. The solemn ordination service, when Hudson Taylor laid hands upon the man kneeling before him, separating him to watch over and feed the Church of Christ, marked an epoch of the work in Shaanxi. It was the first time a Chinese had been ordained there and appointed to a position approximating that of a bishop. It involved a subtle change in the relationship between the mission and the little Chinese churches that had been brought into being and a readjustment in the attitude of the missionaries to the newly appointed church leader. The building of the indigenous church, which was Hudson Taylor's aim, might well have been seriously hindered had not the right type of missionary worked with HSI. With all his gifts and spiritual power, he was known to be extremely strong-willed and not always an easy man with whom to cooperate. But their very newness to the situation and consequent freedom from preconceived ideas about the man, the young missionaries who worked in his district were probably better qualified to be closely associated with him than might have been older ones. They realized their own inexperience in church oversight, even in the homeland, while their short period in China and limited knowledge of the language and customs prevented them from interfering in matters when the temptation to put things right might otherwise have proved too strong. It was with Stanley Smith that HSI first became intimate. He had early been attracted by the young man's sunny nature, willingness to give himself in service for others, and evident spiritual power in desiring to open an opium refuge in Hung Tung, had enlisted his help and cooperation. The mission's approval of the suggestion, having been obtained, premises were evidently secured in the city. The refuge was opened and Stanley Smith was installed. This was in May 1886. In the autumn of that year, D. Hoist joined him, not without an inward conflict. Only after a number of years had passed did he refer publicly to the struggle he had had before going to the station in which he afterwards labored for about 10 years. Although Pastor HSI was praying that Hoist might go to Hong Tong, it was Stanley Smith who invited him to do so. In making the proposal, Smith proceeded to say that when decisions were to be made, it would be necessary that one of them should be in the position of leader and decide matters. Not unnaturally, having already been in Hong Kong for some time and being on terms of close fellowship with HSI, the Chinese leader, he thought himself better qualified than Hoist to fill this position and therefore planned to do so. When he put the matter thus bluntly to me, I was ruffled in my spirit, admitted D.E. Hoist, at a meeting he was addressing many years later. Why should I serve under him? We were about the same age and had come to China together. Granted, he was brilliant with the language, could make easy contacts, and in other ways was my superior. This did not seem sufficient reason to me, so I suggested he should write to the mission at Shanghai for a younger man, as it was their business to make appointments. Later, on thinking over the situation, the Spirit of God probed me, and I was forced to admit that I did not relish the thought of being under my friend. I thought of my face, what friends would surmise, etc. The difficulty was in my own heart. It was impressed upon me that unwillingness persisted. It would mean my having to part company with the Lord Jesus Christ, who dwells with the humble ones, those who willingly go down. I therefore accepted my friend's suggestion, and we worked happily together for several months. Pride and self-will are hateful in the sight of God. They are indeed referred to by the Scriptures as in a particular sense characteristic of Satan himself. It is a solemn fact that they may be exhibited equally in the exercise of oversight and in opposition thereto. We see God's character in the Lamb of God. He was brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and he opened not his mouth. Even in exaltation in heaven, he is depicted as a lamb as it had been slain. That is his character. He is perfectly humble. When we are tempted to exalt self and resent being put down or overlooked, we need to beware. Satan said, "I will be like the Most High." Pride and ambition are essentially satanic characteristics. Everything that savors a self-exaltation is kin and kelp to Satan. The Lord thus, in a practical way, taught me this truth. I believe that crises like this, when we are tested as to our willingness to go down, are the pivotal influences that shape our destiny. Our subsequent ministry springs from the decisions we make in these critical places. The man who was to become a spiritual leader must needs learn the secret of that submission which God can trust with exaltation. D.E. Hoist, therefore, went to Hong Kong and deliberately took the place of junior under Stanley Smith. They lived just as the Chinese around them, not always an easy thing for the Westerner to do. It is not only a matter of eating Chinese food, wearing Chinese clothes, living in Chinese houses. More trying than this to the Englishman, whose home is his castle, is the unaccustomed publicity in which he must be prepared to live. The Chinese know little of privacy, and closed doors are practically unknown except at night. Meals are eaten more or less publicly, and visitors wander into courtyards, interrupting reading, working, or any other employment without hesitation. The missionary who shuts his front door during the daytime and refuses to see visitors is liable to be regarded with suspicion as to his occupation and motive in coming to China. An insight into the lives of the two young missionaries is given in a letter written from Hong Kong by D.E. Hoist. We have the custom here of an open door at all times, so that study is liable to be interrupted. Our dinner hour is the time, however, we generally have squads of 6 or 8 who sit on forms and watch us eat, carrying on conversation freely. There is no doubt it pays, though until one definitely takes it, as in the commission, it is apt at times to be exasperating to have one's meal interrupted to give a lesson in geography to someone who wants to have the mysteries of one of Mr. Stanley Smith's maps explained to him. It gives grand opportunities for preaching the gospel, and then a hymn or two, accompanied on the harmonica, fairly sweeps away any lingering prejudice against us, apparently. The young men spent most of their time, however, in the country. Dividing the country churches into sections, they arranged circuits, visiting between 15 and 20 little centers regularly, teaching the new converts and preaching to inquirers. The ground had been well prepared by Pastor H.S.I.'s faithful and energetic service, and everywhere they went, they found a real readiness to hear the Word of God. Stanley Smith particularly seemed invested with spiritual power in an unusual measure. Speaking of him many years later, D.E. Hoyce said, "He was full of the Spirit. I shall never forget those months I lived with him in Hung Tung. There was such a lot of prayer going up for him. So many people at home had been impressed with him and were praying for him. God used that man. The more he was willing to let Pastor H.S.I. keep his natural position, the more God seemed to bless him. The power that came down was really very great. The Spirit of God seemed sometimes just to fill the place when he was preaching. The 6 months of intensive country work accumulated in a convention held in Hung Tung in the spring of 1887, the like of which had probably never been seen in China. For 2 days beforehand, Pastor H.S.I., with characteristic intensity, gave himself to prayer and fasting, the necessary arrangements for providing food and accommodation for about 300 people were carried out with unusual ease and smoothness. Meanwhile, from the country districts around came the little groups of men and women who so recently had turned to God from idols, eager for Christian fellowship and the opportunity of meeting together to hear the words of life for which they were so hungry. It was at this convention that the largest number of people in the history of the mission to be baptized in one day took the step which separated them openly from the heathen around as being disciples of Jesus Christ. When it was known that 216 people had been baptized in Hung Tung, the news was received with delight in England, but with some apprehension on the part of missionaries in China. Such a mass movement was hitherto unknown. Could it really be that all those who became church members that day were truly converted? In the days to come, Pastor H.S.I. and two missionaries were severely criticized by some for their action. Not all who were baptized on that occasion continued to bear good testimony, and in later years, Pastor H.S.I. and D.E. Hoyce agreed that it was necessary to exercise greater care in accepting inquiries for baptism. While some failed, however, the vast majority of those baptized stood firm. 5 years later, it was reported that of the 216 baptized, 7 were transferred to other churches, 4 had died, 50 had definitely backslided, while another 20 were difficult to trace. Of the backsliders, most of whom returned to opium smoking, less than 20 lapsed into idolatry, while some still continued to hold family worship. 135 remained faithful. There can be little doubt that the convention was a high watermark of spiritual blessing in the district of South Shaanxi. A few days after the convention, the two missionaries set out for a journey up to Taiwan, where they planned to spend the summer months in concentrating on language study. Leading the district in which the gospel was being widely preached and where they had seen a spiritual harvest that had filled them with joy, they were brought face to face again with a great block of heathendom, where was not a single witness for Christ. Compared with the hundreds of thousands of people living on the plain through which they now traveled, who were passing on towards eternity without ever hearing the only name given whereby men can be saved, how small a number seemed the 200 odd over whom they had been rejoicing. With the incomparable sense of privilege to be telling the good news of free salvation to those who had never heard came a consciousness of the inadequacy of the witness. On reaching the capital of the province, D.E. Hoist wrote, "As we passed up the plain, we had grand times of tract distributing and preaching, but oh, what a mockery it seemed to tell a poor fellow who asked about breaking off opium that there was no place nearer than 160 to 200 li. We found willing listeners everywhere, but how one's heart ached as we felt there was not a single man who was caring for these souls, and then thought of streets at home with churches, chapels, mission halls, meeting houses, coffee houses, and institutions of all kinds, while here positively not a single room in which a work was going on in whole cities. May God rouse the church at home further and make them remember the masses. It is just awful. May a gracious God fit one for his service. How he must be longing for anybody whom he can pick up to satisfy his great heart of love in gathering in multitudes of the lost. One feels one has scarcely got a glimmer of John 3:16, God so loved the world. What an infinitely solemn and important matter God must have regarded the salvation of souls as being he gave up his only son. And one catches oneself doubting whether one can give up some little comfort for the same object. Not as much time was given to language study as had at first been planned. In Taoyuan, also innumerable opportunities presented themselves for proclaiming the gospel, and how could they shut themselves into their studies when in the soldiers' camps, among the patients in the mission hospital, and on the streets were people willing to listen to the word of life. In August, when the rains came and street preaching was therefore curtailed, they moved up to the mountains, intending to apply themselves more diligently to their book work. Meanwhile, things were not getting well in Hong Kong. Some of Pastor HSI's colleagues in the opium refuge work, especially one named Fan, who had for some time been resentful of his increasing power and authority, suddenly turned against him, accusing him of carrying favor with the foreigners for his own financial advancement. They deliberately employed men to slander the reputation of the refuge work, and they themselves set up opposition refuge, underselling HSI while using his own prescriptions. The Hong Kong Church, with its large number of new believers, was soon divided against itself, part remaining loyal to HSI, part swayed by the fury of Fan and his adherents. Added to the troubles in Hong Kong, there were unexpected disasters in some of the more distant refuge where the death of some patients involved HSI and much perplexity and distress of mind. It seemed that the principalities and powers of darkness against whom he was conscious of fighting had planned an offensive that threatened to wreck his whole work. Even before leaving Hong Kong, Stanley Smith had felt the urge to commence work in Luan, a city 70 or 80 miles east of Pingyang, and after the summer he soon proceeded to take up his new field of service. D.E. Hoist therefore returned alone to stand with Pastor HSI in his dark hour. What a different state of affairs he found in Hong Kong to that which he had left behind. The church that had been progressing so rapidly was weakened by division, while the refuge work, which had been such a testimony to the power of God, seemed in danger of being overthrown. It was a critical time indeed. There were those, even among the missionaries, who doubted the wisdom of all HSI's methods and who felt that the attack against him might not have been without provocation. H.E. Hoist himself was by no means blind to the faults of the Chinese leader. He was a man who was impatient and had a quick temper, and a defect in his character was this: he was apt to be suspicious. He was very slow to give himself away to anybody. Was it because he recognized the same tendency in himself that the ex-artillery officer understood the Confucius scholar better probably than anyone else ever had? Was it because he, too, was very slow to give himself away to anybody that he did not wonder that he must first prove himself worthy of trust before HSI would trust him? The seriousness of the situation was his opportunity. HSI's own colleagues, who had seemed faithful, had failed him. To whom else but the missionary could he now turn? For all his spiritual power, HSI was but human, and this was one of the times when he needed the strengthening and sympathy of a fellow creature. In the furnace of one of the biggest trials of his life, HSI found the young and inexperienced Englishman to be a friend who proved faithful, one who never tried to rule, but whose aim it was to be guide, philosopher, and friend, as he himself said. One of the first matters that concerned them both was the attitude they should adopt towards those who were slandering the refuge work and sowing seeds of dissension in the church. Should they take drastic action, separating the wheat from the tares, as it were? There seemed much to be said for taking such a course. Would it not hinder the poison from spreading further? Would it not purify the church? But as they prayed, they became more and more convinced that this was not the best way. The exercise of authority on part of HSI would only give Fan and his followers an opportunity for gaining further sympathy in their assertion of the pastor's high-handedness and arbitrary spirit. It was decided, therefore, to go on quietly without any retaliation and leave God to make manifest who were in the right. HSI continued the supervision of his opium refuge and pastoral work, while D.E. Hoist acted as missionary in charge of the station at Hung Tung. It was not easy for him to avoid being drawn into unprofitable discussions with those who desired to bring HSI into disrepute with the missionaries. On one occasion, when 20 or so of them took possession of the refuge at Hung Tung, it was with fast beating heart that he knelt to pray before going in amongst the group of angry men to listen patiently to their accusations and reason with them. Visits to the little outstations connected with the central church provided welcome opportunities for getting away from the scene of so much strife. My journey round the Chao Ching and Fengxi district, he wrote, was a time of real refreshment and rest. I do relish an exercise of walking over the hills in the lovely spring air, and then the kindly, respectful welcome and homely service and chat over God's word is a delightful change from the friction of unreasonable and intractable dear fellows who beset one so at times when in Hung Tung, with grievances and schemes of their own for doing work, which are clearly frivolous and perverse. The policy he and Pastor HSI adopted with regard to Fan and his followers proved eventually to be the right one. After some months, there were signs of disintegration in the opposing party. Fan's true character became increasingly manifest, and some of the men who, sincere but mistaken, had followed him withdrew. Pastor HSI, after a period of prayer and fasting, felt convinced that the final collapse of the rival refuge was close at hand and spoke of it in all the leading centers. If a man abide not in me, he is cast forth as a branch and is withered, was the word particularly impressed on his mind. Rest quietly and wait, he said. We do not need to fight in this battle. Within 3 months you will see the last of the Spurs refuge brought to an end. The prophecy was fulfilled. One by one, Fan's refuges failed, and his chief confederates left him. And within 3 months, he had given up the whole thing. HSI's refuge work, on the other hand, after the period of fierce testing through which it had passed, grew and increased, 21 more refuges being opened during the years following the persecution. End of chapter 4, having been read by Peter John Parisis. None of my audios are copyrighted. Please feel free to make as many copies as you desire to the glory of God. D.E. Hoist, A Prince with God, Chapter 5, Preparation of a Leader. At a period of missionary work in China when few had the vision of a church with Chinese rather than foreign leadership, D.E. Hoist saw that this was imperative if the church was to be indigenous. Towards the attainment of this ideal, his mind was firmly set, and in Hung Tung he was given the opportunity of putting into practice the principles of cooperation which were already well formulated in his mind. He had no intention of bringing in drastic reforms, of trying to force the native church into a foreign mold. He believed in letting it grow after its own order, as live things should. Far more necessary than mere outward forms of church order was that the members should increase in their knowledge of God and His laws.
He realized that by reason of his Christian heritage and upbringing, he had a contribution to make to the infant church in which God had placed him, and that the most effective way of making that contribution would be through the church leader. It was a cause that was wanted, he once said. Pastor HSI was perfectly well able to stroke the boat, and he had got plenty of men to pull behind him. What was wanted was a little man to sort of steer. A great deal of patience and humility were required to work with a man of such a vivid and domineering personality as HSI. The Chinese leader's quick temper was not mellowed in one day, and there must have been many times when the young missionary found it hard to exercise self-control. In some ways, it would have been easier to strike out alone, building up his own work on his own lines, rather than cooperate with this strong-willed man, whose outlook it was often difficult for the Englishman to understand. Had he done so, however, he would have missed what later proved to be the best training of his real-life work, his friendship with Pastor HSI, which deepened in the years past, gave him an insight into the Chinese mind, which he would probably never have gained in any other way. While the experience in dealing with difficulties and problems of the church life in Hong Kong prepared him for dealing with similar difficulties and problems connected with the whole mission and churches brought into being through his agency. The chief way of dealing with these difficulties was always by prayer, and he had unusual opportunities of seeing its efficiency as he worked with HSI. On one occasion, two Chinese preachers who had quarreled seriously came to Pastor HSI about their difference, each accusing the other and demanding his dismissal. Receiving them hospitably into his home, HSI retired to his room, remained there for 2 days without food. When a quarrel of this kind arises, there is not much use talking, he said. You have got to give yourself to prayer, because it is the work of wicked spirits. They are at the back of it, and we have got to wrestle with them, not with flesh and blood, but by prayer and fasting. At the end of the 2 days, the Lord gave him the inward assurance that the victory was won, and he came out to see the men. After the few words about the necessity for confession of personal sin and the futility of throwing the blame on others, he started to tell them that the Lord had convicted him of the mistake he had made in ever putting the two of them to work together. He saw now that they were temperamentally unsuited, and that he should have prayed more about the matter before appointing their work. The two men were both completely melted, each confessing his own unchristian attitude and behavior. And with the tears rolling down their cheeks, all three of them knelt together and was filled anew with the Holy Spirit. In the matter of dealing with workers, both HSI and D.E. Hoy saw increasingly the necessity of very careful handling. Men who have done good work in years gone by may get into a wrong spirit, but you cannot deal with them summarily. If you take premature action before God's time has come, you only aggravate the trouble. And so, in latter years, D.E. Hoist's advice to young missionaries was, never lance an abscess before it's ripe. During the early days of missionary work in Hong Kong, there had been great emphasis placed on the necessity for spreading abroad the gospel, and a number of new converts had been encouraged to go out preaching. Weak in the faith and very ignorant, they were not always consistent in their witness. They would have been more effective living their normal lives at home and telling the gospel quietly to their friends. As case after case of sometimes distressing failures occurred, the missionary and the Chinese leader began to say to each other, "This thing is not of God. It is no good forcing people beyond their capacity. They will only go sprawl," said D.E. Hoist. "We saw it was far better to wait and see the men themselves manifested and then lead them out when they are ready, able for it. Then, when the time had come, we were led. We were always praying about this, praying to God to lead us on, and it became quite clear that the time had arrived and the brethren were ready for it." The progress of the gospel in the district did not continue unchallenged. There were problems to be faced and solved, not only in the ordering of church affairs, but also in dealing with the matter of the persecution of Christians by their heathen neighbors. In the early days of his conversion, HSI, inexperienced and lacking in understanding of the deeper principles of living by faith in God, had been quick to take up the cudgels on behalf of church members whose rights were infringed by angry or crafty heathen neighbors. He did not hesitate to claim help and redress for them from the Mandarin, and on occasion even went to the capital of the province to interview the governor, setting on foot legal proceedings which resulted in the confusion over the adversaries. Thus, poor Christians were shielded from many troubles by this man of position and unusual ability. It was noticed, however, that in each case where this help had been given, the spiritual life of the little community flagged and failed. The natural desire to fight for those who were united by faith and love to the same Lord proved, after all, unprofitable. The decision not to retaliate himself in the fan troubles was probably the first definite step taken by HSI along the path of faith in God alone for this department of life. At first, he stood almost alone. The other Christians could not understand his attitude. As they came more and more to appreciate spiritual principles, however, they were evidently willing to waive the advantages at their disposal through treaty rights and the protection to be obtained through the influence of foreigners and commit their case to God alone. The same principle of meeting hostility and opposition with meekness and quietness proved its value in the progress of the refuge work. Siam, the capital of the neighboring province in Shanxi, was at that time one of the most conservative and anti-foreign cities in China, and to open a refuge there with the object of making known the gospel required wisdom as well as courage. HSI was convinced that it must be done, however, and premises were obtained and opened, and they remained open. D.E. Hoist, who followed all its progress with prayer and the keenest interest, wrote to Hudson Taylor about it. Mr. HSI read me two or three exceedingly interesting letters from Shanghai. You may recollect that some time ago they were helped in getting premises by the Mohammedan military M.A., who broke off his opium with them. Well, at the recent examination, two young scholars who were trying for the degree met their old friend, this Mohammedan, and were at once surprised to see how well he looked. They found out that he had given up his opium pipe, and on asking how this was, were told of the refuge. Accordingly, at the close of the examination, they entered as patients, made rapid progress towards being freed from the habit, and in about 2 weeks left the refuge full of gratitude. At first, being wealthy men, sons of a retired official, they pressed 20 talis on the man in charge as a token of gratitude. But on this, being absolutely refused, they insisted, in spite of all remonstrations, in putting up a tablet on the front door in which the account of their deliverance from the opium habit, together with a statement that this was due to the power of heaven, was briefly written out. In a city where the official classes have hitherto been too hostile, the above is certainly very encouraging. The policy which the brethren there have pursued by Mr. HSI's direction has been to avoid exciting the prejudice and opposition of the neighbors by public preaching and praying, while seeking by private prayer, gentleness, and honesty towards all men to disarm suspicion, looking to God to give them acceptance with the people and establish them in the place. To what extent D.E. Hoist was responsible for the increasingly high spiritual tone of the church and its leaders, it is impossible to say. That Pastor HSI consulted with him in all matters relating to policy there is no doubt, for he completely won the confidence and love of his Chinese colleague. But it was not won quickly or easily. The years at Hung Tong were years of discipline for the young missionary. Not only had he to exercise much patience with the Chinese leader, but to endure quiet disapproval of some missionaries who could not understand his attitude and felt he should have taken a stronger line. But when, one day, Pastor HSI came to him, burdened to tears about some church problems, he said, "Ah, Pastor Hoist, I couldn't get on without you." He thought to himself, "Well, it's been worth it." The friendship between the two men, strengthened and purified by many hours of prayer and travail over souls, had also a very warm and human side. Once during a time of famine, D.E. Hoist heard that his Chinese colleague was living under conditions of great privation. Distressed at the news, he felt an immediate impulse to go to his secour. He had not much money by him, but took what he could and set off on the long walk to HSI's home. It was evidently an occasion when he failed to wait on the Lord for his guidance, for it was only as he was on his way that the unwelcome conviction came to him that he should not give the money. Probably there were few times in his life when he was more strongly inclined to disobey his inward guide, for undemonstrative as he was by nature, he was a man who truly loved his friends, and it grieved him to be unable to give help in this time of need. That he did the right thing by refraining was evident from HSI's own testimony given some while later, when the famine was over, of the special blessing of the private privation had been to him, and how a gift from the missionary at that time would have been a hindrance in the work. But the impulse, so hardly resisted, proves the warmth of V.E. Hoyt's affection for the Chinese who had become so intimate a friend. HSI, on his part, showed equal concern for the things that affected the Englishman's personal life. When he heard that his father, General Hoyt, was seriously ill, he was not content only to pray. He must do something. With great pains, therefore, he prepared some pills, 2 large pint-and-a-half bottles of them, requesting that they be forwarded to England. With the pills was a beautifully written letter giving instructions to the effect that 8 of the red pills were to be taken every evening with boiling water, and 20 of the black variety every morning after breakfast. While his most intimate friendship was with Pastor HSI, however, there were others who meant much to D.E. Hoisty. His regard did not show itself so much in a warm demonstration of affection as in a faithful and sustained interest in the activity and lives of those who were his friends. One simple old countryman named Li, it's spelled P-U-C-H-E-O, whom he came to know and to love while in Shaanxi Province, still had a place in his heart years later when, as general director of the mission, it would not have been surprising had he forgotten him. He was a good friend to those who won his confidence and esteem, whether missionary or Chinese, one who did not forget with the passing years. Some who were his fellow missionaries during his first term of service and later retired from the mission field still maintained a friendship with him, which did not lapse because their paths separated. As young workers, they found him a sympathetic and congenial companion. Unusually prayerful and aware of spiritual movements as he was well-balanced, giving due regard to the claims of the mind and body as well as soul. I am myself more and more a believer in fresh air as a help in nearly everything, he wrote once. He was careful to take exercise by having a good walk each day and kept himself informed of current affairs by reading a weekly newspaper sent out from home. One who was his junior missionary for a time writes of him, "What a kind, loving heart he had. Possibly many at Shanghai who knew him only as director of the mission did not see this side of his character. When at home on the mission station, Mr. Hoyce and I had many long walks, usually in the afternoon. On those walks, we had profitable and interesting conversations, for he was a great conversationalist. I often heard him speak of his mother, also his father and brothers. When he had walked a few miles, we would get to some quiet spot where we had prayer together over the work in any matter specially laid on our hearts. He spent much of his time going around villages and hamlets in South Shaanxi, where there were small churches. Those attending services were mostly poor farmers. He was quite at home with those humble people, and ate such things as they could provide, and was greatly loved. I went round all the villages and churches in Hengtong and Yoyang district for nearly 4 years after he left Shaanxi. Until the last, the Christians were always talking about him, praying for him and hoping he would come back. The work in Hengtong grew steadily. Those who visited the church there were impressed by the reverency in the services and the attention paid to the messages. While there was not again a spectacle draught of fishes as during the spring of 1887, when over 200 were baptized, simple reports in China's millions gave evidence of quiet progress. May 1889, over 400 men and women have been cured on these premises alone during the past autumn and winter season. Of these, over 20 families have put away idols and are learning the truth, and over 100 individual men and women whose families objected to the putting away of household gods, having given up the worship of them themselves, attended our worship besides praying in private. February 1891, the work at Hengtong progresses quietly but steadily, much care being exercised in the reception of candidates for baptism, of whom, as will be seen, there was a large number recently. December 1891, 2 years ago, we baptized nearly 50 people here and had a happy time of worship. October 1893, considering the Hengtong district as a whole, there is great cause for thanksgiving. Altogether, 51 persons were baptized last year. By the year 1896, when HSI died and D.E. Hoyce returned home on furlough, the membership at Hengtong was larger than any other church in the province. But what of the personal life of the missionary during those years, often alone without a fellow countryman to encourage him, strengthen his hands during times of difficulty? Was he never downcast? Those who are actively engaged in the deliverance of souls from the bondage of Satan will never go for long without being themselves attacked. What solemn work really being engaged in God's service is, he wrote, it does bring one into close contact with tremendous powers of darkness. Keep me as the apple of thy eye, hide me under the shadow of thy wings, lead me in a plain path because of my enemies, are two petitions that have come to me with an increasing sense of their fitness, even in my small measure of service and conflict. All the kingdoms of devils are, after all, under the power of our Father, and only afford means through which the perfect counsel and will of God can be unfolded. From the very commencement of his missionary life, he had been brought into contact with unusual, brilliant, and gifted workers. He had seen the wonderful power manifested at meetings when other members of the Cambridge Seven spoke. He had seen the exceptional quickness with which Stanley Smith got a grip of the Chinese language. Now his companion in the work was the masterful and enterprising Pastor HSI. D. E. Hoist must often have been conscious that his own reserved nature and lack of eloquence put him very much in the background in comparison with these more attractive personalities. No envy over their gifts seems to have disrupted him, and in his letters there is a note of sincere joy as he recounts the spiritual triumphs of others. It would be surprising, however, if no paralyzing sense of inferiority ever oppressed him. Indeed, we know it did. He found himself gripped by one of those dark fears which sometimes assail missionaries. He feared he had made a mistake in coming to China. Only those who have themselves known a similar experience can understand something of the anguish of soul through which he passed at that time. The assurance he had been in the will of God is sometimes the steadying factor which brings the believer through circumstances which would otherwise be too much for him. Let that assurance be withdrawn, and the sweetest joys that life can offer are utterly inadequate to give peace of mind. As he thought back over the past, he was honestly convicted that there had been nothing wrong in his motives in coming to China. He had been sincere and deeply in earnest, but I felt, he said, when speaking of that dark experience in after years, that I was not good enough. And now, what was to be done? He seriously considered giving up missionary work and returning to England, but he remembered the widespread interest stirred up by the going forth of the Cambridge Seven. He thought of the great meetings in which he had taken part. How could he go back so soon afterwards and acknowledge failure? How long this struggle lasted is uncertain, but it ended at length when his attention was directed no longer on himself, his inadequacies and impotency, but upon the one who was sowing such seeds of doubt in his mind. An enemy hath done this. At last he saw the matter in its true light. He had been called and commissioned by God to serve him in China, and the devil for whose kingdom he had come to contend was resisting him, not openly, but with the subtlety of the serpent. The realization of the fact liberated his mind from the distress into which it had been brought, and, as always happens in such cases, he was better equipped for his future service than he would have been had he not had the experience. In contacts with young missionaries in latter years, he was able to forewarn them of the special form of attack to which they themselves would almost certainly be subjected sooner or later in their service. 1890 dawned. The year held a sorrow of a very personal, intimate nature for D.E. Hoist, about which his fellow missionaries knew nothing at the time. Gertrude Broomhall, eldest daughter of Hudson Taylor's favorite sister, Amelia, returned to England from China so broken in health that it was feared she could never return. The story of his love for her went back to their first meeting. On one of his earliest visits to Perlan Road, already preparing to go to China, she was then helping her father, Benjamin Broomhall, with his work as secretary of the mission. The young recruit, usually so slow to make a decision, knew as he saw her sitting at the desk, head bent over her writing, that if ever there was to be a Mrs. D. Hoist, this rather delicate-looking, fair-haired girl was she. Why he waited so long as he apparently did before asking her to marry him is somewhat of a mystery, for they were often working in the same province and must have met frequently. Perhaps it was his characteristic hesitancy to take any step before being convinced that it was the Lord's will that deterred him. Perhaps he thought it was not good enough, that he was not good enough. When evidently he did tell her of his desire, she was already in such poor health that return to England was essential and uncertain as to whether she would ever be strong enough to return. She refused to marry him. For both of them, the claim of God upon their lives ranked higher than any other, and God had called him to China. She sailed for home. while he with the heart that must sometimes have been very desolate turned steadfastly to his work. End of chapter 5, having been read by Peter John Parisi, also known as Brian Dean. None of my audios are copyrighted. Please feel free to make as many copies as you desire to the glory of God.
D.E. Hoist, A Prince with God, chapter 6. Marriage and Furlough. It was in December of the same year that a fellow worker was sent to him. Few people are more impressionable than new missionaries, and this young American remembered vividly the 16 months he spent in Hong Kong as D.E. Hoist junior worker. He had already spent 6 months in the language school in Peking when Hudson Taylor went there to designate the new recruits to the different spheres of service. On Dr. Taylor's last day at Peking, he wrote he was to take passage on a Yangtze River steamer. He invited me to accompany him down to the riverbank, where we awaited the arrival of the steamer. This period of waiting gave us ample time for fellowship and consultation about many matters concerning my future in China. Finally, Dr. Taylor said to me, "I have corresponded with Mr. Frost, American director of the CIM, about you, and I believe Hong Kong, in the province of Shaanxi, is the place where you will be happy and where you are most needed. Mr. D. Hoist, one of the Cambridge band, is living there alone. He ought to have a helper, and I believe you can be that helper. Mr. Hoist's life in England, as the son of an officer of high rank in the British Army, did not give him much opportunity to develop household skill in adapting himself to conditions of Chinese life. I understand you Americans are very adaptable to any situation in which you are placed, and you can be very helpful to Mr. Hoist in seeing that he has some of the home comforts to which we have been accustomed. Do what you can to help him have a varied menu in order that his health may not be impaired by conforming too strictly to the Chinese diet. He is a deeply spiritual man, a great Bible student, and he will help you to adapt yourself to Chinese life and methods. Only be sure that you do not follow his lead and go Chinese too far, particularly in the matter of food. Apparently some of Mr. Hoist's missionary friends were fearful he was conforming too closely to Chinese customs, and that in time his health would suffer as a result. I infer that these reports were made known to Mr. Taylor. It might possibly have been for this reason that I was chosen to go to Hong Kong. It is interesting to learn what were the impressions of the new missionary just out from home received of this his first senior. It sometimes happens that there is a sense of disappointment when an enthusiastic young worker arrives at his mission station only to find a lower standard of life and work than he had expected. The keen edge of a willingness for sacrifice is easily blunted by observing a tendency to sloth and self-indulgency on the part of older workers. Little wonder that the first designations of new missionaries are the subjects of special prayer. No such disappointment awaited D.E. Hoist, junior worker, however. Upon arrival in Hong Kong, I found that Mr. Hoist had placed himself in the hands of Chinese servants, and that his meals were largely selected, cooked, and managed by them. He was a man who accepted the principle, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. He lived like the Chinese, conforming to their social and living customs to a greater degree than most missionaries of his day. As he lived alone as a bachelor, his home had almost nothing of the customary English atmosphere, such as imported furniture, curtains, furnishings might impart. This does not mean that he was an ascetic. I adopted his standard of living and found it amply sufficient for health and comfort. I had been with him but a short time before he suggested that I assume the responsibility for the marketing and the preparation and serving of all the meals. I have always wondered if this suggestion had not come from Mr. Taylor, but never questioned Mr. Horst in regard to the subject. Since he was the senior missionary, it was my duty to take over such responsibilities in the station as he assigned to me. I endeavored to vary the rather restrictive menus. Mr. Hoist seemed to be much pleased with the changes made, and I think enjoyed them. The rooms in which we lived were situated on opposite sides of a fairly large open court, some 30 feet wide and nearly twice as long. Each of these apartments consisted of a long living room and partitioned off at one end with a small bedroom. The table on which we had our meals was, at the beginning, situated in Mr. Hoist's living room. But as soon as he placed the responsibility for the meals upon me, he suggested that we should dine in my apartment. The table on which we had our meals was then placed in my room. After our breakfast and our period of Bible study and communion, Mr. Hoist would retire to his apartment across the court for a long period of prayer. He would close the large front doors and usually would spend some hours in intercessory prayer and Bible study. He usually prayed aloud, but in a very low tone, and would pace up and down the room while he was in prayer. He talked frequently about prayer, and I inquired why he walked to and fro during those periods of communion with the Father. His reply was that somehow he seemed to have more freedom in prayer while walking, that prayer seemed more free and unrestrained. During his many journeys through the country to outlying villages and cities, he frequently sent his boy ahead with the donkey and baggage for some distance, while he followed behind on foot and prayed as he walked. The young missionary was impressed by his senior worker's attitude towards Pastor HSI and found himself heartily approving of it. Mr. Hoist often said that Pastor HSI, who was a very spiritually minded man, and who was honored by all the missionaries and Christians, should be recognized as the real spiritual leader, not alone in the work of establishing and managing refuge, but also in the churches, which naturally resulted as men were converted through their trust in God to assist them in breaking off the power of opium. Therefore, Mr. Hoist felt that he should recognize Pastor HSI as the spiritual leader of the churches and cooperate with him as such, and I always believed that he was very wise in doing this. He was criticized by some because they thought he was taking a secondary place or making himself subservient to Pastor HSI. As a matter of fact, Mr. Hoist was about two generations ahead of other missionaries in the matter of placing responsibility for church leadership upon wise and devoted Chinese Christians where the proper qualities of leadership were apparent. At the same time, the missionaries who criticized him were good friends of his. He was always welcome to their homes. I never knew of any misunderstanding between him and any of his fellow missionaries. He seemed to be very friendly with all and would make occasional visits to them. I never heard of his having a friend that he did not retain. At the time I lived with him, one of the Cambridge band had severed his relationship with the mission and was working in a station some 2 or 3 days' journey to the east of Hong Kong. Mr. Hoist visited him and stayed with him for several days, returning much refreshed after his renewal of their earlier close relationship. He much enjoyed social intercourse with fellow missionaries. But what attracted the young missionary to his senior, perhaps more than anything else, was his quiet confidence in God. I do not recall his ever being morose or cast down. Sometimes he was very serious in his conversation, very much in earnest, but always trustful and triumphant. But in spite of the companionship of a fellow worker and evident improvement effected in his living conditions, the summer of 1891 found him with a sense of weariness which he could not altogether overlook. Changji, 45 miles northwest of Hong Kong. On recovering from an attack of illness, I paid a visit to Ho Chau. Then, 6 weeks ago, I came up here and have been having a very nice time in this quiet spot. Our premises here stand on a flat, table-like height, overlooking the little market town, which at this distance looks picturesque, with its heavy roof sloping at all angles and here and there one of those queer, elaborately top-heavy little towers which abound in these parts. One finds the quiet loneliness of the pine-clad hills and the ripening crops of autumn grain very smoothing and refreshing, more so than in the days when one was buoyant and vigorous. The following year there was a famine in Changshu. What this meant to the missionaries is difficult adequately to describe. The continual sight of suffering, seeing people dying of starvation, and being unable to help more than a very few, cannot be a strain on those who love their fellow men. But God is full of compassion, and his tender mercies are over all his works. Although he may suffer his people to hunger, whether for judgment or discipline, he delights to satisfy them. The months passed, and the rain came. Once more the green blades of young corn forced their way up through the earth, this time to ripen to the expected harvest. And away in England, health was returning to a weary body and tired nerves. In 1893, the door to China was opened once more, and before the year ended, Gertrude Broomhall was back. Some months after she returned, a conference for missionaries arranged to coincide with Hudson Taylor's visit to the Providence provided an opportunity for D.E. Hoist to meet her again. Here they became engaged, and then events moved swiftly. Hudson Taylor was planning to travel to Tientsin, and he suggested that they should join his party, accompanying him to that city so that they could get married there. So it came about that in October, number of China's millions, a cryptic paragraph announced. By a wire received on the 5th of September from Tenzing, presumably from Mr. Hudson Taylor, Mr. and Mrs. Broomhall heard of the intended marriage on the following Thursday of their daughter Gertrude to Mr. D. E. Hoist. We feel sure that this news will be received with much interest by all those to whom our friends are personally known. Very happily, they entered into their life together, returning to Hong Kong a few days before his bride, D. E. Hoist, was able to get the home ready to receive her, and when she arrived, she found the rooms gray, gay with flowers, curtains, and with a Chinese scroll from the church members on which were inscribed in gold characters the words, "With one heart serve the Lord." "We are both well and very happy," wrote Gertrude Hoist. "The Lord himself is drawing us closer and closer into a very blessed heart union." This was not effected all at once, however, as she revealed many years afterwards. She did not always find her husband easy to understand. She noticed that when they prayed together, he often asked that they might be helped to love one another, and not unnaturally, this puzzled and rather hurt the new bride. "Why did he pray thus?" she asked him eventually. "Did they not already love one another?" "Yes," he replied quietly, "we do. But Satan always attacks that which is of God's." The suitability of the union became increasingly apparent with the passing of the years. From her earliest days, Gertrude Broomhall had lived in the very heart of the mission, and her intimate knowledge, both of the principles and of the particular problems in its administration, fitted her in an unusual way to be the wife of the man who became its director. Although physically not strong and unable to do much active work, she possessed sympathy and gentleness of manner, which drew confidence and smoothed out misunderstandings in a way her husband, more austere and reserved, could have found difficult, if not impossible. He often spoke of the help she was to him and the strength of her prayer fellowship. In her, the man who was destined to tread the lonely path of leadership always had one to whom he could tell the inmost secrets of his heart. It is doubtful if he ever did so to any other. Very shortly after his wedding, D. E. Hoist received a letter from Hudson Taylor asking him to take over the superintendency of the work in the southwest of Shaanxi, in addition to continuing to fulfill his duties as missionary in charge of Hong Kong. This meant that he would be expected to attend periodical meetings of the China Council in Shanghai. And so at the age of 34, the youngest member present, he took his seat for the first time in the assembly, in which he was later to occupy the most prominent and responsible position for 35 years, and through which he was to direct and influence the life and work of the home mission. His contributions to the discussion of the subjects on the agenda, wrote one who was present on that occasion, even thus early in his missionary career, gave evidence of his grasp of principles and revealed that he possessed the faculty that discerns the germane. But the additional strain of the new work coming at the end of his first term of service was too much for his tired brain and highly strung system. He began to find it difficult to concentrate, and his mind, so well disciplined, no longer seemed able to respond to his will. Thoughts that he fain would banish persisted in harassing him. Perhaps only those who have experienced it can understand the real anguish of soul such a condition can cause one whose chief desire is an unsullied life with God. The concern it occasioned him can be sensed in a letter, mainly concerned with Shaanxi Mission News, in which he confided his problem to Hudson Taylor. Hong Kong, Shaanxi, 4th February, 1896. "My dear uncle, it is with much pleasure that I find myself able to settle down to write to you. First, let me thank you on behalf of Gertie and myself as well, most heartily for your very kind and generous Christmas gift. It touched me so much that you and dear aunt should thus remember us in the midst of your thronging duties and difficulties. Your love and friendship are to me most precious, and your words and actions constantly come up to me in times of perplexity with help and guidance. And this fact has again been an encouragement to me when oppressed with a sense of how little I am able to do in guiding and influencing others, for just as many, many words and acts of yours, noticed by me at different times, have since been used by the Spirit to me. So if only I am with God, my influence may, in its measure, tell. I do long to be more godly. It seems so sad that the heart should wander from God and want other things. As this is a private and personal letter, I want to ask your prayer and advice as to what it is to me a great source of distress and perplexity in my inner life. I find that in prayer wandering thoughts come in, and then in confessing them, often more wandering thoughts come. And in this way, often quite a considerable time will be taken up in a desperate struggle to get clear of the various thoughts and fix the heart and mind in an unwavering concentration on God. You can understand how exhausting this is for one's head. And really, now, by the time one has been able to pray, believing for relief for them all, one's head is often throbbing and one is quite weary. When I see how many are, owing to neglect of private prayer, gross and heavy, and more or less blind, I dare not give it up. Mails are slow in those days, and weeks passed before he received a reply. Hudson Taylor, pressed as he was with work, had little time to spare for writing long letters. In one sentence he told, with simple sincerity, how he himself had learned to pray without strain. Regarding a wandering mind in prayer, I have found more help in praying aloud and praying while walking about, talking as to a present Lord, than in any other way. Nevertheless, that was not all the missionary veteran wrote. He himself had borne burdens too great for his own natural strength, and knew well what it was to be pressed beyond measure. What comfort the younger man, oppressed with a sense of spiritual weakening, must have gained from the next sentence. I do not think that wandering in thought at all necessarily indicates a loss of spiritual life, but it does show a loss of nerve tone and calls for use of such measures as will generally give vigor to the health. That was all the reference Hudson Taylor made to D.E. Hoyes's problem then, but he eventually did not forget it. The man who was indeed the father of the mission had suffered himself from the attacks of Satan upon a mind that had become faint and weary. His own experiences along that line made him quick to recognize that another was in need. He understood, as did his divine master before him, how to treat tired workers. Come ye yourselves apart and rest a while. And so it came about that in May of that year, D. E. Hoyes set out for England on his first furlough. Those who are to be of real spiritual help to others must be prepared for peculiar trials and tests, that the qualities of endurance and adherency to principle, sympathy, and understanding may be wrought out in them. There is no easy shortcut to spiritual maturity. The path to perfection is by suffering. Furlough meant most welcome relief from the problems and responsibilities of his post on the mission field, but it also involved a trial of another sort, for his wife and their baby son must be left behind in China. Just when he was perhaps most conscious of needing the one who completely understood and loved him, he must go alone. There was nothing arbitrary or unfeeling about this decision on part of Hudson Taylor. He felt the frequent separations from his own wife and family too keenly not to sympathize with others who had to make the same sacrifice. But Gertrude Hoyes had only returned from furlough about 3 years, and those who joined the China Inland Mission do so prepared to set aside personal interests and claims when these cut across the progress of the gospel. It is understood that both husbands and wives are missionaries, and that there may be times when separation of shorter or longer duration may be necessary, in order that the work be not hindered. There were others on the field at the time who were needing furlough, but who, because there was no one to take their place, was unable to leave. Had she accompanied her husband, it might have given rise to dissatisfaction, as well as causing criticism at home. They must walk so as to give no offense, either to unbelievers, brother, or the Church of God. Hoyes sailed as far as Colombo with Hudson Taylor and his wife, leaving them there to spend a few weeks with a brother living in India. It is interesting to know what sort of impression he made on one who had not seen him for 10 years. It was his humility more than anything else that his brother observed, humility in little things. In India, where race and caste count for so much, it was an unusual thing to see a white man, with instinctive courtesy, step aside to allow a poor coolie a clear path. While in India, a serious attack of fever further lowered his vitality, and on his arrival in England, it became increasingly apparent that the prolonged strain of life in inland China had taken a heavy toll on his health. Greatly needing rest from all the mental strain attendant on those who have constantly to speak at meetings and make contact with a number of people, He went to Scotland, hoping that the opportunity for quiet, combined with healthy exercise in the fresh air, would ease his weariness and renew his strength. This time, typhoid fever laid him low, and by the time he had recovered from that, his condition was little better than it had been when first he reached home. He was quite unfit to return to China. It was therefore arranged that he should visit Australia, on the one hand for the sake of his health, and on the other that his wife might join him and help in deputation work in that country. In May, therefore, a letter was sent from Hudson Taylor to a friend in Adelaide, making arrangements for his reception there. My nephew, Mr. Hoyce, is about to visit Australia, sailing in June by P&O, and I think it would do well for him to break his journey in Adelaide and spend a month or two there. I believe your healthy climate would do very much to restore his vigor. As you will probably know, he was one of the Cambridge Seven. His father, General Hoyce, has another son for 12 years on the Congo, while another one for several years engaged in missionary work in Paris. Mr. Hoyce has not merely been pulled down by work in China, but had a serious attack of fever in Ceylon on his way home, and typhoid fever in Scotland last autumn. Though not able to do very much, perhaps, at first, in the way of meetings, I think his presence in the colony would be a help to your missionary interests, and especially that of his wife, who will join him from China. She is an admirable speaker. Could you make arrangements for his reception on arrival and assist him in making inexpensive arrangements for boarding? I wonder if Mr. Finlinson would allow them to board and pay for their board with him for a time. The quiet of their country home would be very helpful to a wearied brain. I mention him because when I was in Adelaide, he urged me to send any weary missionary to him. But 6 or 7 years may have brought in great changes, and this might be now quite unsuitable. Mrs. Hoyce's little boy will be about 2 years old. Could you give me any idea what economical board would be likely to cost him in Adelaide, which I imagine is much more healthy than the neighborhood of Melbourne? I hope I am not taxing you too much. It will be a great comfort to Mr. Hoyce to be met on arrival, or to be able easily to find someone who has been in China. Yours affectionately, J. Hudson Taylor. It was only about 7 years since China Inland Mission Council had been formed in Australia. The strengthening of the ties between the workers on the field and the home councils in North America, Australia, and Europe was a matter of paramount importance to Hudson Taylor. Knowing how much the progress of the gospel in China depended upon the prayers and cooperation of those at the home bases. Even he, however, could have had no idea of the value of this particular visit, for at that time it is doubtful whether he had any thought of making D.E. Hoyce his successor. So often it is only in retrospect that the overruling hand of God is clearly seen. At the time it must have seemed that the missionary was needed far more in China than in Australia, and only in after years did it appear how much was gained by the general director having had the intimate contact with mission leaders in Australia, which his prolonged stay there afforded. Shortly after his arrival there in July 1897, he wrote to Mrs. Hudson Taylor, "I find myself very weak and below par on landing, but have been getting better lately, by dint of keeping quite quiet. Everyone is very kind, and I hope on Gertie's arrival to go up to Belair and stay at Hope Lodge with Mr. and Mrs. Morton. Their house is in a beautiful situation on the hills, and I look forward much to being there with my dear wife and son. How thankful I am that our separation is at length coming to an end." Progress in health was made very slowly. In November, writing to Hudson Taylor, he reported, "I have found that my head is still easily made bad again, though when I live quietly and without much brain work, the symptoms of congestion are scarcely ever felt. And this is a great advantage upon my condition in England." In spite of weariness, however, he was not idle, and the little family was rarely in one place for long. "We have been taking several meetings lately, and have just returned from 5 or 6 days in Adelaide. I hope soon to visit two or three places up the country where Mr. Powell, our local secretary, is arranging for a few meetings. Our purpose is to leave here towards the end of November, and after a short time in Melbourne, to go on to Tasmania. This prolonged stay in Australia was probably one of the happiest periods of his life. He was free from responsibility, such as he had had in Shaanxi, in which he was to know an increasing measure in the 37 years of missionary service which, unknown to him, lay before him. Many quiet hours were spent in the shady public gardens in Melbourne, where he and his wife sat watching a child at play. And as they sat there, thankful for the gradual return of health and vigor, they played. This day in Australia, he wrote to Hudson Taylor, has been just one long session that he gives the very best to those who leave the choice with him. Right through, we have seen our Father's care for us in providing us with kind friends and surrounding suitable for our need. It has been strengthening indeed to our faith, and we do pray that after all this time of special love and kindness of the Lord in giving us bodily rest and comfort, we may not fail to walk in His path if it means trial, discomfort, privation sometimes, in order that the gospel may be brought to the Chinese. Meanwhile, the time was drawing near for return to China. It had been assumed that the hoists would return to their own old providence in Shaanxi. It was evident, however, that there was greater need of them elsewhere, and they were asked to go to Honan, H-O-N-A-N, in order to superintend the work there. It is interesting to observe D. Hoist's reaction to the suggestion that he should not, after all, return to Shaanxi. In a letter to Hudson Taylor, he wrote, "Which, of course, on some grounds it would be a very real trial to us both not to go back there. There are some considerations that would make the prospect of work in another part of China very welcome. Enlarged experience and widened knowledge of God's work are things to be thankful to get through at, though the cost of losing some of the closeness of old ties." As his was a mind that ever reached out to acquire more knowledge, it was always the intellectual rather than the aesthetic that appealed to him, and he was not an emotional man. A keen observer, he seemed to retain all he saw and read, applying it to the practical issues of life. To him, therefore, there was a zest in going where he would have opportunity to exercise further the active mind that he had consecrated so wholly to the service of God. Yet it was with deep sense of his own insufficiency that he went to the new sphere of service. "I feel much cast about God," he wrote to Mrs. Hudson Taylor, "and value the prayers of Uncle and yourself much. Few men ever distrusted themselves more than he." In Hunan, he introduced no radical changes or reforms in the work, and thereby avoided arousing the sense of resentment that enthusiasts and enterprising men so often create when they take over leadership. His influence was felt more by what he was than by what he did. He made a great impression upon me and all the missionaries by his prayer life and wise counsel, wrote F. S. Joyce, who later became superintendent of the Providence. He looked at matters concerning the work and the Chinese workers from the Chinese point of view. He emphasized the principles and practices of the mission regarding simplicity of life, enduring hardship for Christ's sake, and honoring the Chinese, and he gave us a fine example in the way he observed them himself. He always carried a burden for perishing souls in his heart. Evangelism was everything to him. His clarity of thought and quick grasp of principle, however, were bringing him more and more into prominence at the quarterly council meetings in Shanghai. His quiet, unimpassionated contribution to the discussions there were such that Hudson Taylor once said they ought to be written in letters of gold. The time was drawing near when he was to be thrust into a position he was to occupy for 35 years. End of chapter 6, having been read by Peter John Parisis. None of my audios are copyrighted. Please feel free to make as many copies as you desire to the glory of God.